Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the anniversary episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Now, you're probably asking, what anniversary? Well, listen to this. This week is the third anniversary of the Game of Crimes podcast. Can you believe it? It's been 3 years since Morgan and I started this show. I got to tell you, I'm shocked. I'm astounded. I'm surprised. But I'm also humbled and honored that you guys continue to come back every week and you continue to support me in the show. I mean, I just from the bottom of my heart, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your efforts. Truth be told, I'm pretty sure the reason you come back is because of the fantastic guests that I bring on here on Game of Crimes. You know, I love talking to these people and hearing their unbelievable stories about serving their fellow man. And in my book, there's no higher calling than that. So this is episode 150. And with next week's episode, Game of Crimes will begin its fourth year on the air. All I can say is, wow. And if you were seeing me right now, I got my arms up in the air. Wow. So believe me, I know none of this would be possible without you folks. You're the faithful, the loyal, the dedicated listeners. And, you know, honestly, just saying thank you, that just doesn't seem to be adequate for the time that you give me to listen to the show here. And if you're a Patreon subscriber, you know, thanks for that as well. Now, in exchange for your support, my pledge to you is to continue bringing you the best and most interesting guests that I can find. I'm just trying to keep you informed and entertained here, okay? You're going to hear things here that you're not going to hear anywhere else. I see comments that come in, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate those. It keeps me motivated to keep going here. I'm always exploring new ways to make Game of Crimes better. And I've received several comments that this introduction section is just a little bit too long. So I'm going to cut this one down some just to see how this works. I'm removing the small town blotter section, at least for now. You know, give me a couple of weeks and let's just see how this goes. And you can let me know your thoughts about what you like and don't like. You're not going to hurt my feelings, okay? If I'm not keeping you guys happy, I'm not doing the job. So let me know what your thoughts are. Having said all that, there is one item I wanted to bring to your attention, and I'm not bragging here. I'm pleased that it happened and somewhat surprised, but I'm guessing almost all of you have heard of the TV series CSI Miami, right? One of the most popular shows that's ever been on the television network. Well, if you remember back during the TV and movie actor strike and the writer strike last year, CBS came up with an idea to do a documentary series called The Real CSI Miami. This is a multi-part TV series that looks at real-life investigations in South Florida, and they bring in real-life investigators to relive and recreate those cases. Their tagline on IMDb says, a docu-series delving into real-life criminal cases and the innovative forensic techniques employed to crack those. Them, not those. I guess they were having a hard time finding talent to be in the episodes, so guess who got the call? Yep, you guessed it. Murph got that call. My agent called, and I was pleasantly surprised. And the reason they called is they were looking for people with experience in the South Florida area. And most of you already know I was stationed in Miami with DEA for several years in the late 1980s, and that's, you know, that was back when it was still the Wild West days. If you don't believe that, go back and listen to the interview I did with my old DEA partner. From season one of Game of Crimes, and you'll hear about the day that we had a big shootout and we kind of lost. So anyway, got the call. I drove down to Miami several times last year in 2023, and I filmed in two different episodes. I haven't seen any of the footage yet, so it's I'm not sure how they're going to get rid of my accent, although I don't think I have an accent. I think everybody else does. But I got to tell you, I did love working with the producers and the directors and the crew members. I mean, their professionalism made the job so much easier, and it made it a ton of fun. It really was. I'm not sure when the episodes that I worked on will fall into their lineup, but I met some fantastic law enforcement professionals that were also filming on the show. So tune in on June 26th. That's the first episode on CBS. Give it a look and see how this old redneck hillbilly did. We'll see how this goes. Is there a future in film and TV? I'm not holding my breath. Okay, now let's get the obligatory housekeeping out of the way. Head over to Apple or Spotify. Hit those 5 stars for me. I know it's a small act, but it really helps support the show, Game of Crimes, and it only takes you a minute. You can send me your comments and your feedback on Apple, Spotify, or you can send it to our email address, gameofcrimespodcast gamesofcrimes@gmail.com. And if you're on Patreon, you can also send me comments on there. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. This is where you'll find all of our episodes, our book list, the merch, which, by the way, is now up and running with a few items. Connie's still working to bring in some additional things. And also, there's a link for Patreon if you're interested in that. Again, that's gameofcrimespodcast.com. On Facebook and Instagram, go to Game of Crimes Podcast. And on X, formerly known as Twitter, type in Game of Crimes. Also on Facebook, now this I really like. You got to go to the Game of Crimes fans. It's a private group. It's the best private group on the Facebook platform, in my opinion. The group is run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, the queen that rules with an iron fist but wears that velvet glove. You can find there lots of posts and comments, and it's a place to go just have a little fun, okay? Check it out. If you're interested in more content, go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. This is where you'll hear a combination of funny and not so funny segments. Things like the monthly Q&A, where I answer your questions, a section in which I talk about the stupid thing criminals do on You Can't Make This Shit Up, and it's that I like that one. I review and rate a law enforcement movie each month on what we call the Narcometer. We've got a section where you can hear a real 911 call, and then you try to figure out what really happened. We call that 911, What's Your Emergency? There's the monthly case review where I talk about one or more great crime-related events. There's a random surprise section where you nor I really know what's going to be covered. It's kind of whatever is going on at that time, and we'll see where that goes. But come on over, check it out. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Okay, as I mentioned, today is episode 150. Wow, I'm just still shocked. But today's guest is a guy named Mike Thompson. I met Mike out in San Diego at the Southern California Game Conference this year, and I'd been told about Mike from Mel and Santi out there, and thank you guys very much. You wouldn't believe how much they do to help support Game of Crimes. If you're a newer listener to Game of Crimes, I typically have guests here who are current or former cops, military, or first responders. You know, that's what this is all about. But occasionally, I do like to bring in someone who experienced law enforcement and the criminal justice process from the opposite side. What's that mean? Well, those are guests who are former criminals. I do this, you know, I like to do this because you can hear crime-related stories from their perspective, not just the good guys' perspective, but what we refer to as former bad guys. To be a really good criminal investigator, and this is going to sound just a little bit cliche, but you need to be able to think like a criminal. Now, most of us didn't grow up like that. I certainly didn't. I came from a middle-class, blue-collar, working family. Mom and dad both worked full-time jobs. My dad started me at my first job at age 14. That was in his carpet store where I was sweeping floors, I was cleaning the bathrooms, I was running errands, and I was just generally being a gopher for whatever needed to be done. But it teaches responsibility, and it starts with that work ethic. My dad believed in starting at the ground level and working your way up. So there was no leeway just simply because I was the boss's son. But that's why I'm honored to bring Mike on today's show. As you're about to hear, Mike had a different, pretty tough childhood. As a young man, he was charged and convicted of a double homicide in California, a crime he still maintains he did not commit. Following his conviction, Mike spent the next 45 years in the California prison system. Did you hear that? He spent 45 years in prison. I mean, that's a lifetime. But you got to listen to Mike's stories, the challenges he faced, the danger he endured practically every day in the prison system, and then how he came out of it on the back end. Think about it. How would you have handled a situation like that? I think you're about to be pleasantly surprised by what you're about to hear. But before we hear from Mike, you know what's next. You know what you got to do. You got to get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. And for this episode, I really mean hold on. This one's going to be just a little bit different. Here we go with the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. Hey guys, it's Murph back with you. Game of Crimes with Murph in the morning, still at the Southern California Game Conference. got a special guest in today. And, you know, I say a special guest for everybody I bring on here, but they are. You know how we like to bring in law enforcement, military, and first responders, and they tell their stories. And occasionally we'll bring in somebody that we call former bad guys. And I'm honored to have today's guests with us, Mr. Michael Thompson. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Thank you. This is a very unique story. I heard about Mike through some friends. I read his book. His book is, and I'll put it on the book page for you so you'll be able to find it there, but it's called The Brand, The Aryan Brotherhood. Now, when I first heard Aryan Brotherhood, for me, that's not a term of endearment, Mike.
No, I don't imagine it is.
I was in law enforcement for 38 years, and, you know, probably like just about everybody else, what I know about the Aryan Brotherhood is only what I read in the news, and it's never good, is it?
No, it isn't.
And, you know, nowadays, even what you read about cops is not that good. So don't believe the media.
Depends on who you ask.
That's true. That's true. But so we're just going to do an interview. Mike's been gracious enough to give me his time today. And what we usually do here on the show, Mike, is just start out, where are you from? How did you grow up? Tell us a little bit about your life.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, first and foremost.
Our pleasure.
I appreciate the opportunity. Situations like this are actually an honor for me.
Oh, nice.
My hope is, in getting interviews like this, is that it has educative value from that perspective that most people don't typically have the opportunity to hear about.
Mm-hmm.
And so it provides hopefully some insight. As you know, I spent 45 years in prison. But to give you a little bit of background on me, I grew up on a reservation, Big Pine Reservation in Big Pine, California, Shoshone Paiute Reservation. First 12 years, abject poverty. People often ask me if I'm native. I grew up native. I don't know that I have any blood quantum or otherwise. To me, it's not really relevant.
Mm-hmm.
I left the reservation at the age of 12 and went to live with my Nez Perce, half Nez Perce, half Irish elder. And he had an Arabian horse ranch and ran blanketing his cattle up in the Cleveland National Forest. So he not only taught me how to be a horseman and move cattle around and everything, animal husbandry, if you will, everything that goes along with that.
Mm-hmm.
Also fishing and hunting. And it was a 12-year-old boy's dream come true. I mean, imagine. But he also taught me my ways. Now, growing up on a reservation, I didn't learn anything about Native American spirituality or philosophy or otherwise. It was abject poverty. I slept underneath a 12-foot travel trailer. I didn't even know what toilet paper was or toothpaste. But in going to live with my elder, he who walks on top of the wind was his full name. I just called him Walks on Top. But he taught me about Native ways, taught me my language. I was allowed to participate in ceremony. We would travel down into Mexico and all the way up into Canada. And he would conduct ceremony. And I had the privilege of chopping wood and carrying water and different things like that.
The privilege.
Yes. putting up the lodge. But he also taught me martial arts. And he was a World War II veteran.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew a number of different styles of martial arts, and in addition to boxing and in addition to Native American grappling. So we kind of combined all those, and he had me make them my own, which I did. And at the age of, I was 21.
Let me ask you just before you go there.
Sure.
Having read your book, so before you were 12, you really didn't have any parents that, in the traditional sense of the word, right? You were pretty much on your own, it sounds like.
I was, yeah. You know, my mother, who just recently passed away at ripe age of 96, you know, she had a great life. But when I had this conversation, when I eventually did, we sat down as adults and talked about what she was going through.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she was raped at the age of 13, and that was her first child. And by the time I came along, I was a middle child. There were seven additionally, so there was 12 kids total. And she just couldn't deal with it, so
yeah.
I ended up on a reservation. I went on and off the reservation. There were times when my grandfather would come pick me up, and he opened a Firestone station in L.A. as a sheriff in 1936. 1952 became a United States Marshal. So the few times that I saw him, I mean, that was my hero.
Yeah, yeah.
And then going to live with Walks on Top, he became my mentor and my hero,
mm-hmm.
and remains so.
But and so I'm looking at you, and for our listeners, I just met Mike in person this morning, so we've known each other now for about an hour. It's just funny how these things work out.
Yes.
But I'm looking at you. You're obviously, you look very white. Mm-hmm. As a white person. You have light colored eyes. Mm-hmm. And as a kid growing up, and I know the answer because I read your book.
Yeah.
But I mean, you just simply because you looked a little bit different on the reservation, they treat some of those guys really treated you pretty bad.
Yeah, they did. I endured quite a few beatings. And, I mean, that's my earliest recollection. I talk a group of liquored up natives, mm-hmm. men, called me over to them. To cut to the chase, they beat me pretty severely. I was able to get away, but that wasn't the first time.
Mm-hmm.
It had to do with my fair features. You know, I learned very quickly that when somebody said, come over here, what for?
Yeah, yeah.
But it had to do with, I didn't identify it as racism. I didn't know what racism was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remained illiterate all whole time until I went to prison. So I had no concept, no actual construct of what was happening to me or why it was happening, other than to think there must be something wrong with me. But, you know, in later years, of course, you look back and you evaluate that and you say, oh. But then, too, in embracing Native American spirituality and having been trained by Walks on Top, I began to understand that the hardships that Native people have been put through and being put on the reservation, you know, everything that they endured. And I do believe there's such a thing as race memory. And so that those things that happened to their ancestors, for instance, there was a carryover relative to that. So particularly when they would self-medicate and get liquored up, you know, white men became the enemy. And, of course, with my fair features, I was the closest target.
Yeah, the target of convenience.
Yes, it was that.
So how did you come to live with Walks on Top?
Well, I was on the reservation, and one of those beatings was about to occur again. It was larger boy. I was 12 and he was 18, jumped out of the bushes. It had nothing to do with skill or anything else. It was just pure fear.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I got him up over my back and was able to break his back.
Whoa.
And, so they moved me off the reservation and I was placed into juvenile hall. But I hadn't really done anything wrong. I mean, I hadn't been charged with anything. He was the one that attacked me. And so I ended up going to a place called Joplin Boys Ranch. It's up in Tobacco Canyon in Cleveland National Forest. And that's actually how Elder Walks on Top saw me. I was 12 years old and we were out cutting fire break. And I loved it. I mean, it was the first time that I was eating. I was, you know, I put on 80 pounds in 8 months.
Wow.
When they sent me there, I was 6 foot tall and I weighed 120 pounds. But so I'm putting on weight and it's a wholesome environment. And the guy that ran the place name was Ray Streit. And all the counselors were ex-Marines, ex-Marine DIs.
That was pleasurable.
Well, I loved him. I really did. And, you know, for yeah. boy, you know, that discipline and I thought it was great. But at any rate, we were out cutting firebreak one day and Walks on Top saw me. He had the ranch next to this facility.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty big ranch. But he liked the way I work, so he came and talked to Ray Stripe and asked him if he could adopt me. They said, yeah. So he came and picked me up, and we went up to the ranch, and I spent the next 8 years with him.
So it's not like you had to go to court and file paperwork or anything?
No.
A little bit different back then, wasn't it?
It was back then, yeah. You're talking about the 60s, early 60s. So, yeah, it was much different.
So he brings in, was there anybody else there, just you and him?
No, it was just the two of us.
What was his, other than he probably needed help on his ranch.
Yeah.
It sounds like maybe he saw something in you.
I think that's probably the case, other than just being a hard worker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that may be, you know, he held the belief, and I currently hold the belief myself, that, you know, spirit will talk to you. And I think that there was something about me, energetically or otherwise, that resonated with him. And so, you know, he followed up with it, which was his nature. When something touched him like that spiritually,
mm-hmm.
you know, by my estimation, of course, he's the greatest man that ever lived.
Mm-hmm. So he's got you out there doing what you love to do, which is, and that's one thing I pick up on the whole book. Your work ethic is very strong.
Yes.
You don't shy away from hard work, not just, you know, not just a job. That's what you enjoy doing.
Yes.
And he's teaching you some martial arts, and he's teaching you respect for the land and how to take care of yourself, teaching you a lot of independence there. Was there any education to go along with that? Formal, you know, book learning, that kind of thing?
No, there wasn't. I couldn't read. It was determined later, discovered, I should say, later, that I'm dyslexic.
Mm-hmm.
And which really doesn't get in the way. Just all it simply means now is that I have to develop my own learning style.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done that. You know, there was a point in time when I was incarcerated that Chaplain Leon essentially is what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
And so he began to start teaching me how to read and write. But with Walks on Top, no. He was not keen on formal education. If I could ride a horse and I could deal with the cattle and, you know, do the branding and the dehorning and castration, and if I could trim the hooves on my horse and float his teeth, you know, if I could make my own tack, including my own saddle, that, you know, I could go out and hunt, I'd go out and fish, I could provide for myself. Those were the things that he believed were critical and essential,
mm-hmm.
that a boy should learn, not so much book learning.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in today's world, you never know what's going to happen next. And you just think, I grew up hunting and fishing, but, you know, I didn't go through anything like you did, but you just wonder if people today, especially young people, could take care of themselves if it came down to that.
I question as to whether or not they could. I mean, just based on my observations, there could be a bias there. I mean, we have that generational thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm in my 70s, and so I look back at these kids in their 20s and 30s, and I think, my goodness, what happened?
I know. And that's a whole other episode.
It is.
Okay, so... how long did you stay with Walks on Top?
8 years.
8 years. So now you're 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
What's the next step in your life?
Well,
is he kicking you out, or are you going out?
No. Until they locked me up, I would go back up to the ranch and, you know, haul hay around. I had that time just shy of 30 head of Arabians and a full herd of cattle. So, and of course, by that time he'd hired help.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I go back up, and I had a few of the horses that were my favorites. I was riding rodeo circuit, and I'd begun doing that with him. You know, he used to take me around to the rodeos as a bull rider. You know, oftentimes that turned into honing my finding skills, because when I best the other cowboys in a bull ring,
mm-hmm.
That night they get liquored up and camp. We used to camp in the olive groves that surrounded the arena. Of course, they come looking for me. You know, unfortunately, I was a big kid. By the time I was 13, especially by the time I was 14, I weighed 220 and was already 6'4".
Wow.
So, yeah. So these cowboys come looking for me. They weren't thinking that they were fixing to fight a boy.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, they looked upon me as a man. But Walks on Top used to just let me...
Fight it out?
Yep, fight it out. And I did.
And did you win?
Yes, I did.
Did you lose?
Well, in truth, no, I never did. In truth, I've never lost a fight.
Mm-hmm.
That's only because of the skill set that Walks on Top gave. My experience is that most men don't know how to fight.
Especially, right.
Especially a man that's liquored out. I mean, that's just really the bottom line.
Your competition in the rodeo circle, were they Indian? Were they white? Who were they? Or just cowboys?
Just basically cowboys, yeah. You know, when you ride the rodeo circuit, it starts, all back then, it started in St. George, Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And then begin there, and then you'd swing up down to the Heber Valley. And what I used to do is had a bunch of farms in that valley. I'd go to the farmers, and I'd offer to bring their hay in out of the field, as they usually got about a 3-cut season there with alfalfa.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd bring their hay in out of the field for them, and I'd get a home-cooked meal, the entrance fee for my next bull ride, and a full tank of gas. I had a 47 Studebaker 1-ton truck, stateside. And all my saddles and tack and gear were in it. Of course, I had a dog, traveled with me, and that was my life. And so he hit Salt Lake City, and then you just swing all the way around the United States. And I think the last one was in Redding, California, at the end of the season. And I think the only time I didn't go back up to Waxahachie's ranch at the end of the season was I wintered over in Carnelian Bay in Tahoe as a boat carpenter, just for the experience.
Which ends up paying off for you down the road.
It does.
These are, and here's what I got out of your book, as the different steps that you go through in your life all come to, I don't know if you'd say fruition, but they all kind of come together at different points in your life to help you get through whatever the challenges or obstacles are at that time.
That's really the blessing, Barry, is that, I wouldn't be here today, just my opinion, of course, but had Waxahachie not taken the time and made the effort to teach me how to fight. I don't care how big you are, that oftentimes is irrelevant. Some of the most difficult combatants I've ever had were actually smaller men, not the big men.
I think when I was growing up, the worst butt kicking I got was from a guy smaller than me, considerably smaller than me.
Yeah. No, but I had endured enough beatings growing up that I knew what it felt like. One of the things that Waxahachie taught me was, as a warrior, there must be a code of ethics. I mean, those are choices. As I grew older, I adopted different Bushido elements as it relates to honor and code of conduct. I don't honestly believe that the samurai actually adhered to their Bushido code, unfortunately. But Waxahachie had taught me that it was important to have a code, ethically, that when you engage in combat. Fortunately, what that did for me was allowed me to choose if I put an opponent down, whether or not I was going to keep him down.
What's the determining factor there?
Whether or not I need to take his life. And I never found that was the case.
Excellent.
So I would pop along, I would do different things like that, then a knife fight, head up, both had knives. But there were a couple that were, to be honest with you, Barry, kind of iffy, because I had one individual that attempted to assassinate me from behind. And when I took the weapon away from him, I took him down, and he pled for his life. Imagine that. And so what I did was I choked up on the knife that he had, and I tattooed a circle around his heart. And just to remember that I'd given him his life. And that was one of the more extreme examples. Typically, when you're engaged in combat, especially in a controlled environment, you're able to ascertain what you need to do, because it happens in seconds. Initially in Old Folsom and in San Quentin, you had blind spots where you could engage in battle, and it would be quite bloody. But for the most part, when you engaged in a knife fight, it was very quick. You're talking minutes. Prolonged minutes. I should have said seconds.
Yeah, seconds sounds more legit. But it seems like minutes.
Well, you're right. It does, especially when you're being shot at.
And we'll get to that, because I was talking to our mutual friend out there earlier about this, and it's, wait till you hear this story for all our listeners. It's some of the things you've been through are larger than belief, just to be quite honest.
Well, yes.
And I've talked, since I've read your book, I've talked to a couple people that have, I don't know how well they know you, but my question is this all true? Is everything in this book true? Because this is one bad son of a bitch if it is. but then I meet you today, and you're, I mean, you come across as a gentleman.
Thank you.
You're very polite, you're very respectful, which that's the way our country should be,
yeah.
I believe. But, okay, so let's get back to, you're on the circuit. Now, I read there where you started doing some construction. It almost sounds like you're not really concerned about having a bank account and saving money, which, that's what I kind of, what am I going to leave my kids? Which my kids are probably doing better than I am. but it sounds kind of like you get jumped to job to get you to the next point in life.
Pretty much. I mean, if you think about just going back to the rodeo circuit, as I traveled, I paid my way by doing ranch work. The odd job here, the odd job there, I never stayed. And whether it was mending fences, dealing with cattle or horses, whatever it was, whatever they needed me to do. Sometimes just repairing tack.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I wasn't asking a lot. You know, these weren't rich folk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these were mostly farmers that were eking out a living. So if I could come in and do a couple days hard work for them and it made a difference in their life, well, then they were grateful. And like I said, my entrance money wasn't that much, you know, for each rodeo. And then tank of gas, they usually had that on grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping them down. Biggest thing, I suppose, was the homemade meal.
Yeah.
Believe me, I ate. I had appetite.
Well, especially after that all that hard work and then your size, your physical size.
Right.
So let's get to the point where you're in an area, and I can't remember the names, but there was two guys that eventually you were accused of murder. Can you kind of get us through that and explain how did you end up where you were?
Well, I just returned from the rodeo circuit, and I had met this gal previously. Husband was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he had died in Vietnam. And she had a son, and her husband's family had her son.
Mm-hmm.
I never even asked her why, but the issue was that if she got married again, then she could get her son back. Now, I'd been up in the Diablo Range Mountains bear hunt, and got snowed in up there, a freak storm. And had to walk out, and I'm walking out, contracted double pneumonia.
Jeez.
So I hit the foothills, came across this tavern, and she was working in the tavern. So, of course, I was sick. She took me home, nursed me back to health for a month. And then in the course of that month, I learned her story. And so I said, well, let's go get married, and let's get your boy back. So that's what we did. And then after we did that, I left.
So when it wasn't a marriage of affection, it was a marriage of convenience for her.
It was, yeah. And don't get me wrong, she's a nice gal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back on the rodeo circuit, and I'd returned from the rodeo circuit. And so I dropped in, check on her and the boy. And they had a couple of acres. And so her cousin had just recently been released from Soledad prison. So I met him. And her other cousin, this gentleman's brother, had just come back from Vietnam. That's really the first time I'd experienced anyone with PTSD coming back from Vietnam, and he had it to the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
So the elder of the two went to work for two drug dealers out of Soledad when he came out of Soledad. I don't know if he knew them before or not. But over the course of a few weeks, he was explaining to his cousin that the two guys he worked for, who were drug dealers, had been arrested by the feds and were out on bail. And so they knew this guy that ran essentially a marijuana cartel in Southern California, and that they were going to kidnap his children and abscond with the ransom money to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, first thing I asked him, I said, boy, you're going to let this fella know, right? She said, no, I'm not going to get involved. And I said, give me his phone number. And he did. And I called the guy. And I told him just what he had told me. This is what was going to happen. So eventually, it appears they did try to kidnap the kids. And in the course of that attempt to kidnap, they were killed and buried. So I was accused. You know, I went into trial. I'm pretty naive.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never been in trouble. And so I thought all you had to do was get up there and tell the truth. It didn't quite work like that.
How old were you at the time?
I was 21. And so, you know, the guy that was actually the trigger man on killing these two drug dealers and the father of the two girls testified against me. And so they essentially turned it all around. I maintained my innocence, but I was convicted. In fact, I was the only one that was convicted of all the charges.
Wow.
Yeah. But anyway, so off to prison I go. First experience with prison, being locked up.
What was your prison term?
It was 7 to life.
Okay.
And in 7 years, I'd be eligible for parole. So off to prison I went. I went to Chino, the reception center.
And this is all in California?
Yes.
Okay. 21 years old. Wow.
Green, too. I mean,
I was trying to think of a nice way to say that.
No, well, I mean, I was so green. I had gills.
Yeah.
technically not was.
Yeah.
But I had no idea what, you know, gangs were or any of that, let alone, you know, the ins and outs of, you know, controlled environment, prison culture,
mm-hmm.
racism.
Right.
Huge learning.
Well, you know, in listening to your story, it I think all boys, you know, when I grew up, you know, we used to watch Gunsmoke and Wagon Train and all those different TV shows. And you kind of dream about being a cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's portrayed as this glamorous life. But then you hear the truth of it through your story. And I don't know if you've ever seen the Yellowstone series that's on TV with Kevin Costner. It's that's a cowboy life. And they show how rough it is. I mean, how...
Yeah,
you know, you're dedicated to surviving every day, to keeping yourself alive and doing
hard work and keeping the livestock alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the main thing. People don't realize that you've got a lot of predators, and you know, when you corral an animal, you're responsible for that animal's well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, it's hard work. But to be honest with you, I always loved it.
Yeah,
really did. It just and there's something about it.
Mm-hmm. So, welcome to prison. Just tell when you got to Chino, you know, you're an intake for several weeks, right?
Yeah, you go through a psychological evaluation and testing and everything, and I couldn't read or write, so they had these bubble sheets, and so I just, you know, randomly filled in the bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
Come out pretty good, actually.
Just ABC.
Yes. Yeah. And so... Had a few altercations when I first came in, but I was scheduled to go to San Quentin. But as it turned out, they had a bus they called the Grey Goose. When the Grey Goose came around to pick everybody up, and you caught the chain.
What's that mean, caught the chain?
When you line up alongside the bus in order to get on the bus, they take a chain and they run it all the way down in front of the prisoners. And then they put waist chains on them, and then they pick the chain up and they attach the waist chains to the chain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's catching the chain.
So you're all chained together?
Yes.
Okay. So if one tries to escape, everybody's got to try to escape.
That's pretty much it, yeah.
Are your hands free?
No, your hands are handcuffed to the chain around your waist.
In front of you?
Yes.
Okay.
And then you've got using the irons on too.
And you get in that bus, is it, how many guards are in there?
You've got one in the back with a shotgun and two in the front.
Okay.
So.
I'm shaking my head because I don't know how people, and there's a room full of law enforcement corrections people out there right now that specialize in gangs. I don't know how anybody could work in a jail. I was a cop for 38 years. It never interested me in the least to go in the jail.
I used to tell them all the time that I couldn't do their job, and I still believe that.
I couldn't either.
I just couldn't do it. What they have to tolerate,
mm-hmm.
That's not in my character.
Yeah, verbal abuse, physical abuse.
Yeah, absolutely.
No respect. And God bless them. I'm not certainly not downing them. God bless them for what they do, because I know a lot of the folks out there in the auditorium right now are listeners of the show here. So love what you guys do. I just couldn't do it myself. Okay, so you're on the bus, and where are you off to?
Well, I'm supposed to be going to San Quentin, but they don't have the bed space, so they send me to Dual Vocational Institution. That's in Tracy, California. And back then, they called it Gladiator School. And it was.
Wow. That's an intimidating term in itself.
It can be, yeah. Essentially, what you have is that was my first introduction to gangs. Down there, it was in Nuestra Familia. I was completely naive as to what gangs were.
Mm-hmm.
So I got my first job, and it was with the chaplain. The deal was it had two chapels with a garden in between. And the deal was that I'd take care of his chapels, and he would allow me to use his garden to practice my ways, because back then it was against the law to practice my ways. Couldn't speak your language inside, and you couldn't practice your ways.
And you're talking about your Indian ways?
Yes.
Okay.
So, but he was...
Let me ask you, I don't know anything about Indian beliefs, mm-hmm. the spirit world, and what I read in your book. It's probably the most I've ever read about, to be quite honest with you. Mm-hmm. But here you are with, is he Catholic or Protestant priest?
He's Protestant.
And had you ever had any introduction to formal religion like that?
No.
So what were your thoughts about, well, this guy, is he crazy? Because I know, you know, I believe in this, but he believes in that. Did you learn from him, or was it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was a good Christian man.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived a good Christian life. I mean, he really cared about the prisoners. You know, it's like he had a bookshelf, one of his offices there in the chapel. Somebody had painted it.
He
loved the look of wood. So I took that bookshelf apart and I stripped paint, sanded it, stained it, varnished it, put it back together for him. We'd removed the books. And so we were putting the books back up on the shelf and I was handing them to him and he came to me and said, "Oh," he says, "this is one of my favorite books." And he opened it and he says, "Here, read this." And I said, "Well, I don't have my glasses."
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me and he said, "Can you read?" And I said, "No, sir, I can't." He said, "Would you like to learn?" See, that's the kind of man he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, yes, sir, I would." He said, "Okay." So
that's a motivational man right there. He didn't put you down because you couldn't read. He just
let me know.
Okay, now we understand that. Let's teach you to read.
Yeah, so he understood my native ways. And he understood also, back then they didn't know what the dyslexia was, but he understood I was having difficulty with comprehension. So he'd go out, he'd get Fells and Stream and horsemanship, different things that I'd actually experienced in my life so that when I was reading it, I could make that connection comprehensively. And it made a difference. But and he used to love to watch me go out in the garden and dance and sing you know, he would hear me sing out there and he'd call me into the chapel and he'd say, "Come on up here." And he'd be up on at the altar. And he said, "Let's sing this song together." See, just totally uninhibited, unbiased, unprejudiced.
Mm-hmm.
And we would sing together, you know, whether it was the old Rugged Cross or whatever it was, and have fun doing it.
Very cool.
It is very cool. He was just a really, really good man and had a positive impact upon me.
Well, before you went in there, you really didn't have any experience with a custodial type environment. So I don't even know if you had preconceptions about what to expect in there, but do you think you would have expected to find a man like that inside the prison?
I didn't have preconceived notions about, prison or, the guards or anything else. You know, my greatest difficulty was surviving. And I understood that that was the task before me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I oftentimes tell people that, when I was released from prison 45 years later, I was astounded at how emotionally immature I was. So that, you know, at the age of 21, 22, when I went to prison, my emotional regulation was arrested. And I didn't understand that until I was actually released 45 years later, that I was so amazingly immature. Fortunately, I have a wife that didn't hesitate to point that out to me.
Back then or now?
Now.
I understand your wife was the encouraging factor, motivation behind you writing your book, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. She's not only a genius, but she's a hell of a woman.
Yeah. Let me just go back. And it just hit me. I should ask this when I ask you what your sentence was.
Mm.
How intimidating was it when they told you you're going to prison for 7 years to life, or 7 to 45, or whatever it was?
Yeah, it was 7 years to life, and it meant I was eligible in 7 years, but, I'll tell you the story. It put me in that cage. That's what I always thought of it as, was a cage, something I wouldn't do to an animal.
Mm-hmm.
But there I was, and I thought, I'd be on in the mountains, rodeo circuit, and just now I'm standing in this cage. And
you're like the freest man I know.
Yeah, and I said to myself, I don't think I can do this. It was the only time I ever contemplated suicide. I
thought, really?
Yeah, I thought maybe I just need to end it here, figure out a way to do that. And I saw a rock sticking out from the top of the wall. You know, when they construct those prisons, they have a lot of aggregate, you know, in the cement itself.
Right.
And there was a fairly large rock sticking out from just below the ceiling line. I went up and I put my hand on it. And in my belief system, those are the rock people. And it spoke to me. And it just simply said, "It's going to be all right, Colin." That's all I needed. That's why I actually wear this around my neck. It looked just like that rock.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he's got a necklace on. It looks like there's some turquoise in that.
Yeah, it's a balsam. Yeah, I keep doing the same thing.
Sorry.
It's balsam and turquoise.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the one, it was what I used to call bird stone, bird rock, speckles in it. And that was as close as I could get to it.
Wow.
And so I've had this for decades.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all I needed. And that was the only time I never gave it another thought. All I knew was that the task before me was to survive. That's what I set about to do.
Yeah.
And is, you know, it's made, they call it back, I don't know if they still call it that, but we call it doing your own time.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that's what I was trying to do.
So you went at 21. What year was that?
1973.
Okay. All right, so you're there with the chaplain. He's teaching you to read. When was how were you received by the other prisoners, and how long did it take before somebody decided to challenge you?
That's the thing. I mean, it's always amazed me that you know, when you're a big kid, and I was a big young man, you know, by then I'm 6'4" and I weighed 285.
Mm-hmm. You don't look like you ever had any fat on you.
I haven't.
Yeah,
but. Yeah, you're right. I don't know what it is about men in general that when you have a larger man that they think that that somehow is a challenge. So, you know, on occasion I did receive a challenge. I mean, going back to Chino, there was a fellow up on the stage in the field house that was bringing mostly white boys up there, putting 16-ounce boxing gloves on them and then beating the hell out of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew how to fight. So I went on up. I didn't want to, be honest with you.
He invited you up, right?
He did invite me up, yeah. And so I went on up, and I don't know what he expected, but it didn't turn out the way he wanted.
What would have happened if you said, I don't have time for this crap?
I don't rightly know. I mean, to be honest with you, it never occurred to me.
Not one to turn down a challenge, I guess.
I suppose that could have something to do with it. You know, I played sports when I was younger, threw a javelin and a discus. And so, but I was never competitive group wise and was always competition against myself. So that I found that men in general, particularly within a controlled environment, are extremely competitive. You know, the idea of cooperation, I don't think ever enters their consciousness. So, yeah, I had a few occasions where, you know, that occurred. I didn't bother anybody. I spent at 5 o'clock in the morning, I'd go into the chapel. I did have one friend. His name was Pone Vaisiong Puresa. He was from Western Samoa. And he was actually much bigger than me. He was 6'8 and weighed about 340.
Wow.
And had the fastest hands and feet of anybody I've ever seen. We used to go down to the field house and spar.
No kidding.
And yeah, so we had a great time. But we'd spend all our time in the chapel, cleaning the chapel. And then when different denominations would come in, I would assist them, you know, get their hymnals and you know, whatever they needed. And sometimes would attend just because I found it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And Pone would do the same thing. And sometimes Pone and I would sing for him. But other than that, you know, I started lifting weights. That took me up to 310 weight-wise.
Jeez.
Don't you remember back then, the prison system was different. They had their own butcher shop, their own pig farm,
mm-hmm.
their own dairies. So, you know, I could get a gallon of fresh milk with a flat of 30 eggs. You know, 10 raw steaks. I used to eat steaks raw. And, you know, for the protein.
Yeah.
And that's all changed now, of course. But, you know, that allowed me to put on a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine fish, you know, having to feed you and your buddy that's even bigger than you.
Actually, he ate more than I did.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I'd say the state was losing money on you two.
They were.
So you've had this, but then back to the emotional upbringing here. When you say it froze, is it because once you got in the prison environment, that's what it was for everybody, or you just didn't have the opportunity to learn more? I mean, you're in a very controlled environment.
It's actually both, Perry. I mean, it's the idea that you're not having experiences where you have to engage in emotional regulation. Everything is about survival. So you engage what's called stoicism. You become stoic,
mm-hmm.
and you stuff everything. You don't allow yourself to feel, can't afford it, gets in the way. You know, surviving. So primary focus is survival. The more that you do not engage in emotional regulation, the more it slips away. And you don't even realize it. You don't even notice it. because every day is a routine day in and day out of, you know, the gates are going to rack. You've got to be prepared when that door opens to meet whatever comes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your focus.
Every day is a threat.
Oh, yes, of course.
So your goal is just to try to get through that day.
Yes.
Wow. Whew. I can't even imagine. Well, I mean, what I was going to say is what a limited future you have at that point.
Well, you do, and you understand that. You see it. You know, so that when someone like Chaplain England, for instance, offers to teach me how to read, that's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And the fact that I can practice my spiritual leaves, I can go out in the garden. And like I said, Pone was Samoan, so he would go out and slap dance and, you know, sing his songs. And I would go out and I would dance my dances and sing my songs. And, you know, eventually got a little hand drum that I rattled, a prayer fan. And so, you know, those are escapes, essentially, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So you'd mentioned racism. You'd never experienced that before. What did you see in the prison? What's the breakdown? Explain that for our listeners, which you would.
Back then, you had approximately 70% black, and then the other split between Mexican and white.
Mm-hmm.
But whites were the minority. So, and then your gangs, you know, I hear a lot of people talking about how the gangs were racist this and racist that. Not Rick. I certainly didn't have a racist bone in my body. You know, ultimately ended up joining the Aryan Brotherhood.
Which is surprising.
To a lot of people it is, but if you understand that that's what I was just talking about, that the gangs exist to control the resources, just like organized crime does on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So controlling your resources is controlling your community, and all the assets and resources and revenues that can be generated from that. And so that's a control mechanism. It's controlling your environment. So if you have a population of from 3,000 to 5,000 prisoners, that's a small city.
Mm-hmm.
And if half of those prisoners are receiving 50-pound packages from home, which was allowed back then, plus you wore your own street clothes, you see, as opposed to the pajamas they make you wear now, then, you know, there's a lot of revenue that goes into that. You put up a steel, put up another steel, you've got narcotics coming in. You got prostitution, you got loan sharking. It's organized crime within a controlled environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it generates a lot of money. And so that's the focus of the gangs. That's what they're after. They want to control that resource. All power bases within a controlled environment have an economic base,
mm-hmm,
of necessity. And so, you know, that was true here. It's not really something I gave any thought to. I was not interested in it. I didn't, be honest with you, care about the environment. I was just interested in doing my time.
Mm-hmm.
Those few things that brought me enjoyment, like practicing my ways,
mm-hmm,
lifting iron.
We're getting a lot of background noise here. I apologize to our listeners here. Hopefully editing will take some of this out. The conference is on break right now, plus there's a daycare center here at the facility where we are. But and that was, I mean, the financial thing has never been a burden for you.
No.
I mean, quite honestly, it does become a burden because you're thinking how we're going to make ends meet, that type of thing. But somewhere along the line, are you getting challenged from the other groups, or you can't just be a man on an island in a prison environment?
No, it's not possible. In my case, what happened was that I was practicing my ways out in the garden. And so by that time I had a small drum, a rattle, and a prayer fan. And I was dancing. I would dance and I would sing, and our dances are always prayers, as are our songs. So now, I was told later that the priest in the Catholic chapel took issue with what I was doing, probably because of my fair features, did not understand what I was doing, and associated it with devil worship.
Oh, gotcha.
So as it turned out, some of the parishioners in the Catholic chapel were helped to acquire weapons. Now, back then, the boot factory was at Tracy, and when they made the boots, they used to put a spring steel,
mm-hmm,
flat in the arch, and so they'd sharpen those to a point and glue them back on both sides, and, you know, I doubt very seriously if any of these fellas had ever even been in a fight because they had the pieces taped into their hand. Usually, the only reason you do that is because you're afraid you're going to drop it, or it's going to be taken away from you.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, I had these seven guys come through the side door one day when I was out there dancing. and ended up fighting them. It was more like Keystone Cops as opposed to a fight. I mean, these boys couldn't fight a lick.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually did some real damage to them and felt bad about that. I thought, no, I overdid it here. I didn't need to do this because I'd broken some arms and a few other things that I wished I hadn't. I didn't need to go that far.
Mm-hmm.
They probably scared me. And so I responded accordingly, viciously.
What was the motivation for them to attack you?
Well, to appease the priest's feelings about my devil worship out in his garden.
So he either knowingly or indirectly precipitated this attack.
I have the utmost respect for Catholicism and priests in general, mm-hmm. any man of the cloth.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that hard to believe. I think what probably happened is that his parishioners overheard him talking about it and his concern for it and deciding to take it upon themselves to do something about it.
Gotcha. You know, I hope that's the case.
Yeah, me too. It is.
What group were they affiliated with?
They weren't affiliated with any group. You know, people said the Nuestra Familia, and I do believe the Nuestra Familia supplied the pieces because you couldn't get a piece otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably taped the pieces into their hands. And
mm-hmm.
They were called back then. They were called Border Brothers, and Paisas is what they now call them. They're now actually a gang.
And this is, are these all Mexicans?
Yes.
Mexican-Americans, I guess, or just Mexican. Wow. So at the same time, I'm probably jumping way ahead here, but where do you get to the point where you've got the Mexican Mafia, you've got the Aryan Brotherhood, you've got the black gangs? Is that coming up soon, or is that already where you are?
Well, no, it's not where I'm at. It's coming up soon. It is a result of this altercation with these individuals, these paisas in the chapel. I went after the leadership of the Nuestra Familia, believing that they had incited it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went out and put hands on them. That turned into a pretty large-scale situation where they attempted to kill me in my cell unsuccessfully. And so...
Can you tell us how? How did they try to kill you?
Yeah. When I put hands on them initially, they locked me up in the hole, and then they let me out with no charges.
When you say describe what you mean when you say put hands on.
I attacked the leadership. Mm-hmm. And this particular time, I used a baseball bat.
Just one or one person?
No, there were other people out there that saw what I was doing and joined me. And so it escalated.
Oh.
And so for the first time, the leadership of the Nuestra Familia had been challenged. And so it escalated from there.
Mm-hmm.
It became all-out warfare, which I engaged in.
Mm-hmm.
But before that happened, they let me out of the hole and put me in G-Wing, third tier, last cell all the way at the end. And even I knew that wasn't right. Something was happening. Something was coming. And sure enough, next morning I heard the bar box unlock and the doors were thrown. And I looked out, and here they come. There was four of them, suited and booted, coming up the stairs. They had to come up these stairs. And so I waited for their turn into the third tier, and I swung over to the second tier from the third tier and came up behind them. The last two that were in line, two were going into the cell to get me, and the last two in line, I threw over the tier. So I followed the other two into the cell. One of them ended up stabbing me in the hand. If I hadn't put my hand in the way, he would have got me. And I put the other one down between the toilet and the bunk. But so I walked into the clinic from there with a knife sticking through my hand. And it kind of freaked the nurse out.
That's something you don't see every day.
It is, yeah. So I decided that I needed to increase the issue. Yeah. I needed to escalate even more. So I had an old boy out, Gary, smuggling a 38 Smith & Wesson. So I made it's a revolver, so you can't silence it, but mm-hmm. I'd made a suppressor for it nonetheless. It's, like holding a pillow up to something. And I had a box of shells smuggled in. My plan was that there were four units there. I had 24 rounds. I was going to go in, and I was going to execute six in each unit. Now, the fellow that smuggled it in.
You were going to kill 24 people?
Yeah.
Wow.
that's where I was at in my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were trying to kill me. Unfortunately, the administration there was not doing anything about it. So it was up to me to do something about it. And so I needed something that was drastic.
I mean, all I can say is damn.
Yeah. So I had the gun smuggled in and a box of shells, 24 rounds, and made that suppressive. And then the fella I had smuggle it in got cold feet, told on me. So I'm standing in the center corridor and I feel a shotgun in the back of my head.
Was it the butt of a shotgun or the barrel?
Barrel.
Okay. That'll get your attention.
It does get your attention. And so two guards come up alongside me and cut my clothes off me because I guess they thought I had it on. And they locked me up in the hole. We'd just gotten a new warden. So he calls me in and I told him, I said, well, don't know where you're going. I said, but if you let me out there on the mainland, I says, I reckon I could find it for you. And of course, he wasn't going.
Mm-hmm.
So he put me in a car and shot me up to Old Fast.
Was there any doubt in your mind that if you had attacked those guards, that they'd have pulled the trigger on you?
None whatsoever.
You believe they would?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because they believed I had a gun on me.
Mm-hmm.
If I were in your place, I would have pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
That's simple.
So you're off to Folsom.
Yeah. Now that's the big house. These are the big boys.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is Mexican Mafia, Black Guerrilla Family, Black Panthers, Texas Syndicate, Sibonese Liberation Army, Charlie Manson and his group, and a few others. And this is all the leadership of these groups.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hey, players, this is the end of part one. As you know, part two comes out tomorrow on a Tuesday. In the meantime, on social media, go and check us out on X at Game of Crimes and on Facebook and Instagram at Game of Crimes Podcast. Also on Facebook, type in Game of Crimes fan page and join us for some more fun. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including all our episodes, the book list, which contains the books written by our guests, Game of Crimes merchandise, and a lot more. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.